This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
All right, so welcome back to the Iced Coffee Hour.
It's Millennial Money.
That's right.
Yeah,
it is.
Wrong show.
Wrong podcast. Put that blooper at the end of it.
Same room, though.
Put that blooper at the end of it.
Welcome back. Jeremy, you are back.
I'm back to Vegas.
How was Arizona?
Oh, it was beautiful.
It was beautiful. That snake was terrifying.
It was a diamondback, man. Those are deadly snakes.
Oh, my gosh.
Jeez. I know. Incredible.
So, and how's Arizona?
It was beautiful.
Why do you go there? Just for family?
Yeah, we got a house there, and it's nice to just kind of get out of town, do some different stuff, and... you know, Graham visited us for a very short amount of time.
Oh, you did?
I did. Yeah. It was crazy to get there. It's supposed to be a 45-minute flight. And so you get there and you realize the airport looks like they're doing like a 90% off sale with the amount of people that are there. It's like I'm waiting outside of a Supreme store, like trying to get into the airplane because so many people had bought a ticket to go to air. Well, no, seriously, the entire airport was packed.
Wow.
Yeah. Because there's delays, the airline trying to get in, like we didn't board until like 3 hours later. Then when we landed, they were so busy at the other airport that we had to wait on the tarmac for like another hour. So this whole thing that should have taken 45 minutes, probably like an hour and a half with travel time, whatnot, ended up taking like 5 hours to get there.
So he would have been faster if he had drove. He would have arrived to our house much quicker. If he would have drove, it would have been about four and a half hours.
Yeah, and I was asking the lady at the front because I wanted to like, bump up the seat to be able to board faster, and she was saying that there's a pilot shortage.
Pilot shortage.
Yeah, they literally don't have enough pilots. And so I was just like,
imagine they're like, and the guy who's flying you today, he just got through training. It should be okay.
Well, and then that's the other thing. I've never heard of this before, so I looked it up online, and apparently, what a lot of airlines are doing, they're now lowering the requirements to be a pilot, and then they're also paying more. So,
that's fun.
Because you got to think, like, imagine spending $50,000 for pilot school, spending years training for this to then be offered a job for $35,000. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So they don't have enough pilots right now. A lot of them also retired.
What's the salary of a pilot? $100,000?
No. It was like $40,000-$50,000. It's not as much as you would think. And now they're bumping it up. Yeah. Now with over 60
for commercial airline pilots.
Yeah. It's not as much as you would think. And you would expect that, you know, $100,000 or something like that.
Hold on. I don't believe you. Wag, we got to look this up.
Also got to thank our sponsor, FTX US, down below in the description, where if you sign up using our link, you will get free crypto on every trade over $10. But we'll talk about them more a little bit later on.
Yes. And so, Graham, what did you think about Arizona? Let's hear that once you finally got there.
Well, let's see how much pilots get paid
okay.
first.
So there's a range, obviously, but I'm seeing between, on salary.com, 110 to 180.
Wow. Okay. So 180 if you're super experienced. Wow.
Yeah. I figured they made in the mid.
Look for a new pilot.
Oh, yeah. Sure. New pilot. Yeah.
Because this could be heavily skewed by the guy who's been doing it for like 30 years.
Career Builder says 40 to 130. Yeah. So that's bigger.
That sounds more in line with what I was,
I thought maybe the 80 to 120 would be around, right? But It's interesting because now they're changing the law. So if you've been Uber driving for more than 3 months, you can fly a plane. It's amazing. So if you're looking
if you graduate high school too, it's just a GED.
I feel like every kid has wanted to be a pilot at some point or another. Yeah. I know I wanted to. I wanted to go to Embry-Riddle. Was it Arizona? Where is it at? Embry-Riddle. I don't know. Anyway, I wanted to go to pilot school and
Have you guys ever played Grand Theft Auto before?
Of course.
No. Dude, the most fun thing to do is flying, is it not? True, it's like getting the plane and you fly or the helicopter or whatever. Like that was always
The game Flight Simulator that's pretty much like flying a plane. So if you could do that, you may as well just fly a plane.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Graham's like, I used to play Grand Theft Auto. I would just collect all the money.
Just keep it safe in the bank. Just protect it.
Just protect it. Yeah. Don't do any crimes.
Yeah. I drive safely. I make sure to pay my taxes always and just accumulate. I'm in that accumulation phase.
Dude, that was the best part of Grand Theft Auto when you'd play it safe and you'd like drive. Yeah, that's when you know you got so bored with playing it for so many hours. It's like, I'm going to play safe now. Red light. Oh, I got to stop.
It's so true.
We've all done it.
But anyway, Arizona was really nice. I was really impressed. I was telling Jamie, like, why are you living in Arizona? It's like the same thing as Vegas. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of thought, because I've driven through parts of Arizona and it reminded me kind of Vegas. And I arrived to your area and it's so nice. Mm-hmm. You get there, it's like green. It's a weird mix between Los Angeles and Las Vegas. Mm. The cactuses were incredible.
Oh yeah.
The greenery was so nice. It was a really established city. And I love the buildings. The architecture was, to me, like a 10 out of 10. The business is really cool. It's really nice. Yep. And the house you showed me was a Toll Brothers home. And Jeremy like toured me through this house. Was like, how much do you think it is? And to me, another house. And I said, well, you know, probably $5 million. Because it's like you walk in and there's like this courtyard and it overlooks the entire desert. It was so nice with the infinity pool. This thing was how much? 2.6?
I think 3.3, but that was with furniture included, which the furniture was at least probably $200,000.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, incredible. It was really nice. Like this would have been, if this were here, I would buy it.
That's cool. Even so right are you now, thinking about buying it, Jeremy?
No, I don't buy it. Down at those low price brackets is too low for me.
Much like Tattooed Chef at the low price points.
Honest Tattooed Chef, baby. That's it. But it.
Wait a minute. So that house that you bought in Arizona, when did you buy it?
That was a 2020.
2020, okay.
Yeah, and it closed at the end of 2020.
So it was like right at the peak of the pandemic.
Yeah, it was when I bought that one.
So you got a deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I bought both of these right in the crunch time of the pandemic.
Wait, like, how much did you buy the Arizona house for?
The Arizona one was, that closed for like $600, and now it's worth about a mil.
What? Yeah. Oh my gosh, it's a mil now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy crap.
Incredible. Yeah, but you know, I'd love to say I'm good, but that's just luck. You know, it's like I never obviously you anticipate real estate's going to increase over time, but like that sort of appreciation, 40%, like.
Speaking of real estate, do you guys think this year we're going to keep going up or do you think we're going to go down?
Well, can I say this? You got an offer on your house, didn't you? Did you ever get it in writing or no?
No, I'm sure I could, but it's one of those things where it's, you know, if I'm serious about it, they'll go through the process.
Get it in writing.
Yeah.
So if we could recap here, you bought a house.
So I bought a rental house to rent out for 1.3 and I got a loan on it. I put down 20%. At a 2.6% 7-year ARM. And the same day that I closed, we got an offer from another broker. My real estate agent called me and he said, hey, someone's willing to buy it for 1.6, which is nuts. I haven't even owned it for a day yet. Yeah, incredible. And someone's offering me $300,000 over.
First of all, I'm suspicious because the house was listed.
Yeah.
And how long was it listed for on the market when you bought it?
Like 2 days.
Listed on the market for 2 days, but still $300,000. And Andre bought it at 1.3. And were you competing with another offer at that time or no?
Yes, I was.
And then someone pays $300,000 more. I told Andre, just get that in writing and take it. $300,000.
Yeah, but it's incredible.
I don't want to flip it though. I want it as a rental property.
Think about. I don't know.
Isn't money made when you buy houses? Well, not really.
Yeah, I was going to say it really comes down to if you have a better place for that 300 right now. That's my opinion. If you had like, you're like, oh, I got to get this 300 in Bitcoin or something.
Listen, the fact that I got that loan at 2.6% means I'm already up on that money.
Yeah.
You're not getting another loan for $1 million at 2.6 right now. It's just not possible.
But you should have gotten the 30-year fixed. Because those are now at like 4.5%.
True, but when I was going through it, it was at 3.5%. which to me, 2.6% is a pretty substantial difference, especially if it's a rental.
It's a write-off, Andre. Like on a rental property, you should have locked in for 30 years. What did you just say? 3 point something?
3.5.
Now they're 4.4, and it's a write-off.
Sure.
In your tax bracket, any write-off against rental.
I'm still going to get write-offs.
I know, but it's an extra write-off. Like, I guarantee you're not spending all the money that you're making. So this is an extra write-off. You may as well have just taken a higher interest rate.
Isn't that a case of, like, I'm going to spend more money just to save more money? Like, I don't want to spend a dollar to save 10 cents.
But you're locking it in for 30 years. So the issue becomes, after 7 years, where's the market?
I feel like after 7 years, our rates will go back down. Because if you look at the trend line for interest rates, they always trend towards zero.
And if they go back up, you're paying a lot of money.
True, but
and,
at that
the
point,
risk, the risk is like the difference between 2 point something and 3.5. I mean, true. It's like no difference to lock it in for 30. I mean, it's very little.
But at my price, you know, my income bracket, I feel like even if rates do go up substantially, it's still going to be affordable, number one. And number two, if it doesn't, I could still sell it at that point anyway, probably for more than I bought it. So I don't think it's that big of a difference. And right now, getting cheap money.
A lot of assumptions, Andre. Rates are going to be lower, and I could sell it for more than I bought it for.
Oh.
Hmm.
Well, people promised me the real estate dream.
Those real estate guys. So, you know.
No, but seriously. So this year, you guys think real estate is going to go up or down?
Well, I think, based upon the trend, it looks pretty darn good. The interesting part is, I think, kind of viewing past this year and trying to figure out, are we destined for this crash, right? When we hear things like that, immediately what people think about is, oh my gosh, there's another housing crisis on our hands. When somebody buys a house and the next day they got offers to buy it back from them, people automatically are going to say, dude, that's stupid. Like, that should not be happening.
True, but I feel like if we're looking for signs of a bubble, like those have happened so many years ago with NFTs and just all this crazy stuff. So I don't know. It doesn't seem out of the ordinary. Considering how inventory is so low, I don't know. It seems like this year real estate's going to keep going up.
I'm just saying, I'm suspicious of a buyer coming in after closing $300,000 higher.
Yeah.
On a house that was listed.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of time during escrow. How long was the escrow? Like 2 weeks?
Well, here's the thing. Normally, the escrow was a month. So normally, I will say that I think you're right, but in that specific community, the cheapest house you can buy in there is like 2.5-3 mil. So I bought the cheapest house in probably one of the nicest neighborhoods in Vegas, which I would say that's the exception to that.
Well, see, and I mean, at the end of the day, some people don't care. Like let's say somebody coming in the area, they got the money, right?
Yeah.
Say a new athlete or something, they're like, I want to live in this area. And they miss that deal and like, oh, this just sold. What if we offer them something? You know, if the inventory is so low.
Exactly. Especially if you want to be in that community, but you don't want to pay $3 million. Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah.
And I've seen some crazy offers in that community.
Yeah. It's just that's the market we're in right now. Yeah. Inventories are low. Is there anything else anywhere close to that price bracket in there right now available?
Nope.
Yeah. And so that's where it comes down to. Imagine you're coming in the area. You want to live in that specific community.
Yeah.
You're like, hey, this house just sold. Oh, maybe we can talk to them.
Yeah.
Realtors talk as well. Maybe they're like, oh, this guy's looking at it as a rental anyways.
Not to mention the fact that all the other ones that are near 2.5-3 mil, they're two-story, whereas mine is a single story.
Yeah.
Which I think is just more desirable.
You get in writing, and then you counter. Just say, hey, put it in writing. I'll consider it.
Yeah.
And then they submit at 1.6, and then you counter and say, listen, I don't really want to sell it, but 1.7, I'll be enticed. Give me 1.7 right
now. You think that's worth it?
Yes.
100.
Yes, I would. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, so hold on. After taxes, after realtor fees, let's be realistic.
You can negotiate the realtor fees. It's not on the market.
Let's say
it's an off-market deal.
Let's say 1.6, right? So that's a $300,000 difference from my purchase price.
Mm-hmm.
After taxes of, let's say, 37%. That'd be short-term capital gains taxes, right? So 37%?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's 37% off of 300? Let's say...
Well, you
none of us,
we'd be 400.
None of us are that good at math.
No, I don't want to say 1.7. I'll say 1.6. That's the offer I got.
Oh, okay. So
that's a $300,000 difference.
Yeah, you're talking like 180-ish?
No, it's closer to 100, I think.
No, I'm talking about what you would get.
Oh, right.
You would get
after fees.
Yeah, you're going to net after fees 250.
Well, he's going off of fees. 1.6
you're going to negotiate those fees. It's not listed. It's an off-market deal.
Well, let's just say that I can't negotiate. Let's just say I have to pay those realtors.
You're not going to.
Okay.
No. As a realtor, I'm going to tell you, you're not going to. But okay. And then what is it?
You're saying 37% tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be 180-ish, wouldn't it? Somewhere around there. Roughly.
160.
See, that's 160. Not 160. Losing that house in that neighborhood for 160 is just not worth it to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I look at the ROI on the cash, though. How much do you put down on that?
250, I believe.
That's a good return. You put down 250, you make 160.
Yeah, and true. What if you get 250? Let's take it up. You know, you counter. Let's say at 170, they do it.
True. Yeah. That's a different story, but
And 250, then you're looking at that, and you know, what's your 5-year price target for Bitcoin?
But see, here's the thing.
Because that's the way I think about it. I'm like, you know, put that 250 in Bitcoin.
Specifically,
if you think it's
Bitcoin?
If you think it's going to 5X, 10X.
Here's the way I also look at it, is that you're, Andre, really only banking on appreciation. Mm-hmm. And maybe that happens, maybe it doesn't. But for cash flow, it's not a good property.
No,
for
you're
cash
right.
Flow.
It's not. It's
so
not the
I'm
best.
Looking, it's like you're holding this property for 7 years really only to keep the loan on it as an inflation hedge.
Yes.
If inflation comes down.
Also, remember, I'm underweight real estate, so I can't be like, I'm just going to put Bitcoin.
But you could find another property that maybe cash flows a little bit better.
True. No, it actually would have been better off if I had bought like four, three normal houses than that one.
But yeah.
I specifically wanted that one in that community. Yeah.
I was really into buying a more expensive property and renting it out here because I thought the luxury market in Los Angeles is really good. If you buy a $2 million property, getting like $12,000 to $15,000 a month, you could do that. Mm-hmm. Here, I'm shocked. You could buy a $2 million property and it's up there for like $7,500 a month. Like it's cheaper to rent those houses than
here,
to buy.
Right.
And when I was talking to some realtors about it, they just explained that the rental market isn't that solid in the higher price points. A lot of those people who pay that buy something instead.
Right.
It's really
and
not
that could flip though over the next decade.
That's true.
Yeah. As a community just gets bigger and that's you get true. More people kind of coming in and leaving and whatnot.
And I also feel like that 1.3 is kind of that sweet spot where you could have a family of say doctors or lawyers and it's kind of affordable for, I don't know if it's the average person, but you know, it's still, it's not like a $3 million crazy house. Yeah. You have to be some celebrity to get it.
Yeah. 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 As you get, you know, one of the biggest things for our real estate market for the high end, that is all the sports franchises. You know, now we have the hockey team, football team, massive. If we get basketball, baseball as well, just the amount of athletes that come into your area is immense.
And what's crazy is they're only looking at two areas. They're either looking in that neighborhood or in yours.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those two places, either in Summerlin or in that area.
Yeah. Devontae Adams, it was interesting. He's a super famous receiver for the Packers, you know, like one of the best in the league. And he had just bought a $12 million house in the Ridges.
Mm.
And everybody starts speculating, oh my gosh, I think he's coming to the Raiders. And then there was nothing, and actually he was going to do a deal with the Packers. Next thing you know, all of a sudden he got traded to the Raiders last week, which is huge. He got the richest contract in NFL history for a receiver. I think he's going to make over $30 million a year.
Holy crap.
Just from the Raiders for playing receiver, man. That's should have crazy. Been athletes. Dang it, man. That's where the real money's
you could
at.
Be an
we're mathletes. Get it? Mathletes.
Mathletes. I like that. Oh, my goodness. But anyways, so, you know, Andre, like you're underweight real estate. So you're looking to get more involved in real estate. All right. Mm-hmm. What about stocks? Are you underweight stocks? Or
I
you...
am. I think I'm a little underweight with stocks. Okay. Yeah. I don't have that much of a big portfolio relative to my net worth. It's only like, I want to say 550K, 500, maybe 600,000, which is not that much. I'd like to bring it up to the just a 1 mil.
Yeah.
Keep it there.
I have a few stocks for you.
Honest.
You ever heard of HNST?
But Andre has more in crypto.
I do.
All thanks to the sponsor of today's video,
FTX
US, down below in the description. FTX is a place where you could buy, sell, track, and trade a multitude of cryptocurrencies and NFTs right from your phone, all in one place, with fees that are 85% lower than the top competitors.
Incredible. Yeah. Absolutely incredible.
They've also partnered with Steph Curry, Tom Brady, the Miami Heat Stadium. They've done quite a lot.
The coolest CEO out there.
Sam Bankman-Fried. Yeah. Oh, by far. I've wanted to go down to the Bahamas just to be able to meet the guy. Get him on the iced coffee hour.
Oh, I was going to say, could you imagine that? Yeah. Dude, that would be epic.
I was epic vacation ever. Got to do it.
I would be so anxious going down there because I wouldn't be able to be on vacation. I'd just be like, just thinking, I need to get the video with like, Sam.
Come on, Sam, let's film the video.
Yeah. Sam, we can't wait. It's got to be. Oh, Sam, do this face for the thumbnail and just have a No, no, look more scared. Look angry. Look sad. Anyway, guys, if you use the link down below in the description, you could get free crypto on every trade over $10, and their crypto debit card is used and accepted throughout millions of merchants worldwide. So if you're interested, the link is down below in the description. They help support the channel. And Sam Bankman-Fried, by the way, is incredible.
Yeah.
Go and look him up afterwards, but not during the podcast. But yeah, afterwards you can do it.
That was smooth as butter. Yeah.
I love it. I try.
Yeah. Thank you, FTX, as always. All right, gentlemen. So market's coming back strong. I'm sure you might have seen in your portfolios. It's an interesting move. NASDAQ, 9% in 6 days.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's great.
Six trading days.
So explain to people watching, why is the stock market going up recently?
So, I mean, we had a lot of fear priced in. You know, as of, if we went back to, it's either Monday of last week or Friday of the previous week, we were down about 22%, roughly 21, 22% on the NASDAQ.
Year to date.
That was since the 2021 high. Okay. So since about November,
okay,
which is an extraordinary move. Like when you talk about 20% plus on a major index, that's a huge move. And then the same thing with the Russell was in bear market. So there's so much bad news already priced in. You had Russia, you had oil, you had recession fears, which is just like a fear, which you could always have that fear.
Rate fears.
Yes, rate fears. And now the BRICS, I call it the wall of worry. The BRICS are starting to slowly crumble. And as you get those BRICS to slowly crumble, what ends up happening is the market kind of brings up. And a lot of these stocks are still at disgusting value. That's the interesting part, is we've come back quite a bit, but I think it's just a very small amount compared to how much some of these stocks are going to climb over the next, you know, few years as we kind of dig out of this massive wall of worry that's in front of us.
It's going to be so funny when people look at stocks today and they're like, no, they're so expensive though. They've already gone up 15%. I'm too late. Yeah. And then just imagine the market drops. No, it's going to get worse. I'm not going to buy it.
Yeah.
That's just the mentality.
Yeah. I remember at Tesla when it finally started going up, I started buying that stock 2018 into 2019. And at first I was down in the position. And then next thing you know, it finally started to turn toward the back half of 2019. And next thing you know, I was up like 20% on Tesla, then like 30% on Tesla, then 40%. And I remember there were some folks that like, dude, you had to cash out now. Like it just made a huge move.
Yeah.
And obviously now it's up like 2,000+% you know, a few years later. But that's the thing. When you get that initial first move, and especially when you've been through a lot of pain, people are like looking at like cash, like, oh, we finally made a profit, cash. Because when you've been down for months or even a year,
right,
it's like when you finally get that breath of fresh air, you are so quick to like, I got to take this profit because it might be gone.
Right.
Which is a very different mentality than we had a year and a half ago in the market.
Right. So, have you noticed that tech stocks are coming back the most, or is the small cap market coming up?
Yeah, I would say it's the riskier the play, the faster it's coming back. Okay. Because those ones got hit the worst.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, small caps are riskier than tech.
Are seen as riskier, yeah. Okay. It doesn't necessarily mean they are.
I wouldn't say they're it's more just volatile.
Yes.
Yeah.
More
volatile.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a way
bigger swings.
Synonymous with risky.
More volatile. You get bigger swings. That's all.
Yeah.
The highs are higher and the lows are lower. We'll make it that's the technical way of
like,
calling it.
Let me put in some smart words in here. Volatile.
Yeah, when it moves over the 200-day, Andre, that's when you got to look at that 50-day moving average and decide if it's going to the 100-day moving average next or the 1,000-day moving average after that. And so I'm just kidding, okay? None of that matters.
I was going to say, oh, this doesn't sound right, man.
Look at the 10,000-day moving average.
Oh, gosh. But anyways, yeah.
But not until you adjust for inflation.
Oh,
Inflation-adjusted 1,000-day moving average.
Oh, that messes up everything.
Yeah. Ooh, speaking of inflation, what do you guys think is going on? Increasing inflation this year, or are we going down?
Still increasing, in my opinion. I'd love to hear your opinion, Graham, but I think the rate of increase is going to start to slow in 2 months from now.
Why 2 months?
Because that's when we started already having that insane increase in inflation. And so I think we're going to see a more of a moderation where inflation is going to keep increasing, but the rate of increase is going to start slowing because the comps get easier and easier. We got this month as a tough comp. Next month's a tough comp. After that, we're, in my opinion, in the clear as far as that increase.
Yeah, I would agree with you. The issue, though, is we still have rising prices throughout a lot of things. Supply chain is still not normal after all of this time. Mm-hmm. Issues now with energy prices going up. And I know, it's most likely going to be fairly temporary. I don't know how long it's going to last. But I could see prices going up another 3 to 5%.
So there was a study, not a study, but a research paper kind of that was published by a guy named Zoltan Pozsar, who used to be a senior advisor to the U.S. Treasury. He used to serve for the Federal Reserve in New York. And he was kind of like the point man for some of the chief senior officials for the Federal Reserve, White House officials, and U.S. Treasury.
Okay.
And he published a paper called Bretton Woods 3.0, where he talks about like the next evolution of money, right? So Bretton Woods, just so anyone unfamiliar, is the agreement we signed in 1944, which basically put the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. And he says that in his paper that he's trying to warn basically people that there's a kind of a tidal wave on the horizon that people aren't seeing coming. Mm. What he's talking about is the commodity crisis because of the sanctions placed on Russia. So commodity prices are going to be extremely volatile, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you choke Russia's commodities, which, by the way, Russia's not even in the top 10 like exporters of commodities, but it's extremely rich in certain commodities that are extremely important to markets like gas, oil, and a few other things. And if you cut off the supply of those commodities from Russia, you're increasing the volatility, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the equivalent of like if you have a stock for like Coca-Cola and it's worth whatever, $50. Well, that stock we can agree is $50 no matter where we're buying it on, right? Mm-hmm. But let's say somebody's like, oh, I don't want that Coca-Cola stock. It's from Russia. I'll give it to you for $30, right? Now you're increasing the difference between the bid and ask spread. And now no one knows what the stock is truly worth because it's so volatile.
Yep.
But commodity prices, they're... So Russia is kind of acting like, remember in the 2008 subprime financial mortgage crisis where people were packaging these CDOs and they kind of affect, like they were selling them to poor pension funds and they hugely affected the markets. Well, these Russian commodities are like these toxic CDOs where nobody wants to touch them. Mm-hmm. So that's increasing the volatility in the commodity markets and it's only going to get worse. Because all these commodities, they're packaged up into assets, derivatives.
Yep.
And if you increase volatility, especially in the margin market, right, margin trading, then you get, called.
Yeah.
And then you get that sell-off.
Yep.
And so this guy's saying that, like, we don't know what's going to happen. Normally, when something like this happens, we have a Federal Reserve to step in and just buy up whatever needs to be bought to close the gap, right, to stabilize the prices. Yep. But we can't do that this time because it is the Western banks that are doing the sanctioning.
Mm.
So his thesis is that China is going to be the one to basically money printer go, right, in Chinese money.
Yep.
The renminbi?
Oh, yeah. That's another term for it. Yes. Either yuan or okay. Renminbi.
So yuan, right? They print the yuan. Mm-hmm. They buy up those Russian commodities that nobody wants to touch because they're sanctioned, but China doesn't care.
Yep.
And now you have stronger Chinese currency, weaker U.S. dollar, and that could be the birth of that new world reserve currency that Ray Dalio was talking about in his world reserve order, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah.
Because it's like it sets it up so perfectly. And then he says if Bitcoin's still around at that point, then it's going to be hugely profitable because right now the world is watching in real time as Russia has its foreign exchange reserve wallet frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're the leader of a country and you're paying attention, you're like, dude, is the dollar really an asset or is it a liability?
Mm-hmm.
Do I really want to hold my reserves in dollars or some other currency?
Mm-hmm.
That's why if people park some of that wealth in Bitcoin, because it's a money that's not governed by any country, it maybe it's a little bit safer.
Yep.
So I just thought that was a fascinating paper.
I don't know. What, you got to think, too. It's like, why would they park money in Bitcoin? And I see the appeal, but again...
I'm not saying all of their reserves into it. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying like Bitcoin is going to be just some. Even if it's 1% of the world's $400 trillion wealth, 1% is $4 trillion.
Kind of like a lot of countries put some of their money in gold.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So okay, $400 trillion is how much the world's net worth is. So 1% of that is $4 trillion. The current market cap of Bitcoin, I believe, is $700 billion. Mm-hmm. That's a roughly like 4 to 5x in current Bitcoin price, if even 1% flows into it.
Mm-hmm. But I think when you look realistically, it's probably not going to happen for a long time. The US dollar is still pretty strong. It's pretty stable. There's not a lot of other great alternatives. Gold does not have that sort of volatility where all of a sudden it's down 10% in like an hour because someone decided to sell. So I think for those reasons, it's going to take a very long time. And even then, it's always easy to say, well, if 1% buys this, I don't know. I mean, I think it could take a...
I will say this, and it's always funny when I have to defend Bitcoin, but...
defending Bitcoin.
Yeah, I know. I'll defend anything as long as I can argue with somebody.
This is crazy.
You see this?
This is crazy.
Wow. Okay, but I'm listening. Okay,
what I will say in Bitcoin's defense is I think it's becoming less volatile than we've ever seen it.
Yes.
You know, And even when we saw that big sell-off from almost 70K down to the low 30s, it held well. And today, I think Bitcoin's at about 42.
Yep.
I think it's becoming less and less volatile. The thing is, the more folks that buy Bitcoin, right? And like you two gentlemen, you have no plans to sell Bitcoin. Bitcoin could probably double tomorrow, right? And you guys probably aren't cashing, more than likely, 99%, right? So when you get more and more of those folks out there, right, and they're just not cashing, even when you get these moves, it's going to be more stable. And never mind, you add on the people that aren't just holding but are buying. And I think that's just massive for Bitcoin for long term. And so I think it's going to become less. The bad news with that, the one bad news is, if you're expecting any even remotely close to the type of returns you got from Bitcoin in the past, you know, dream on. You can still probably get some great returns from Bitcoin over the next, let's say, 10 years. But that if you're going to take it away on the downside, you're also going to take away some of the upside. It's like kind of viewing Tesla stock. Yeah. It's like, you know, Tesla, you're not going to make nearly as much money in the Tesla moving forward as you did in the past. The folks that are usually the earliest of the game are always the ones that get the most. But it doesn't mean you can't make some money.
Yeah. And so are you implying that maybe countries could have a reserve in Tesla?
Could you imagine? Elon would love that.
World reserve Tesla shares. No, but if you were to time travel to 2017, right? Just not that long ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, almost.
I keep thinking 2017, 3 years ago.
I know, right? Yeah.
Oh, gosh. We're still all stuck so in 2020.
Time, yeah. But yeah, if you were to tell those people who bought at the top of $20,000, like, so many people were heartbroken, like, oh, dude, I bought at the top.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, don't worry. Just a couple of years from now, Bitcoin's just going to be floating around 40,000 stable. Like, that's incredible.
It is.
It just goes to show you that even if you buy at the top, as long as you dollar cost average into it, you're going to come out ahead.
Yeah.
In the long term.
The interesting thing is, I think if you told some people that held Bitcoin or were buying Bitcoin at that time, it's only going to be at 40,000. I think there's some folks would have been like, oh, I'm selling Bitcoin then. Because if it's only going to 40K, because a lot of people put these insane price targets on. You know, even like we've heard, you know, the 100,000 price, the million price. And a lot of times these just aren't hit, obviously, or even remotely close to being hit. And so I think some people, you know, especially at that time, we're still caught up into the, like, it has to 10X from here and it has to 100X. And if it doesn't, it's bad.
Right.
So. What's interesting, I don't think Bitcoin's quite attracting the same crowd it may be used to. Whereas before, it was like, I gotta buy Bitcoin because this is my chance to 100X my money. I think it's more attracting a crowd now that's like, I'm going to make money in this over the next 5 years or 10 years. How much money? I don't know. We'll see, but I'm going to make a good amount of money.
Well, I think if you were to tell people from 2017 that now you're attracting institutional buyers and countries...
Mm-hmm.
People would have lost their mind. Like, you're kidding me. Now you get those buyers, it's game over. And this is just the start. Yeah. So to be fair, I do think Bitcoin by the end of this decade will probably be closer to 500,000, if not 1 million.
Okay.
Then it will be closer to 40,000 or zero or whatever people sometimes think.
I would agree with that. I would say if I had to take one of those bets.
Why aren't you buying more Bitcoin, Jeremy?
I might.
Using our sponsor, FTX.
Yeah.
You get free crypto on every trade over $10.
I might buy some Bitcoin through FTX very soon.
Jeremy, tell me, okay, it's interesting that you're like warming up to the idea of Bitcoin.
Yep.
Was there anything that, because I would love to take whatever that is and channel it to people that are kind of similar to you in the sense of like they don't like it or they don't want to invest in it.
Yeah.
What is it that did it for you that maybe is becoming more clear that wasn't clear before?
When it comes to Bitcoin, it's really just seeing how passionate people are. And at the end of the day, if you want to give value to something, right? If enough people want to give value to that dang thing, it becomes valuable, right?
Right.
And so with the Bitcoin community, and the thing I've always, you know, respected, at least for the last few years, is how loyal people are to Bitcoin. And even folks like you guys that just, you know, you're holders, you're buyers, and you're not sellers. And so I'm like, well, If that's the type of community that's attracted here, that's a pretty cool investment community, right? So I think Bitcoin still comes with risks of like if something better comes along or something like that, and people are like, ah, Bitcoin's the old thing. Don't buy Bitcoin, buy this other thing. That's the one risk I see. But you know, a lot of people just look at it as kind of like digital gold.
But
hold on,
it's
going to be a tough thing to.
I appreciate that perspective, but. From a different perspective, like if you were still against Bitcoin, if I was to tell you that, you'd be like, well, that's just a herd mentality, right? Like, why would I put my money into something that so many people believe in? Like, they're buying at the top. Like, why would I chase that?
Yeah.
So how do you transform that part? Like, how do you?
Yeah, I think it's very much a similar philosophy to like gold, mm-hmm. which I've never bought any, you know, I've bought one time in my life. I held gold for like 3 days, like gold ETF or whatever. but that's about all my gold experience. And that's why I've never been the biggest fan of Bitcoin either. Mm-hmm. Just for the mere fact that I'm like, I like things that can produce me cash flow. Companies can produce me cash flow over time, right?
Got it.
Even if you buy a money losing company at that time, as long as it flips to the other side, it becomes a cash flow company. When it comes to gold, Bitcoin, things like that, it's not producing necessarily anything. It's just people are buying it because they believe people are going to use it to exchange value over time. And which is kind of attractive, and there's no doubt it can go up over time. If more and more people are transacting in Bitcoin and more folks are saying, I'm going to take more Bitcoin off the market, ultimately, that's a pretty darn good thing for the value of Bitcoin over time. You know,
yeah. Has the war in Ukraine shed light on it for you as far as like the utility goes? Because I remember we argued a lot and you were like, who uses this stuff? Like, yeah. no one's using it.
Criminals and Andre.
Criminals and Andre.
There's a fine line there.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. They're pretty much the same thing. No? Oh, gosh. Yeah. But no, I think that's a great point. And I think you know, Russia's probably learned this and... yeah. So at the end of the day, I think the investment case is stronger than it's ever been for Bitcoin. Mm. And I think that's ultimately a good thing. And when it comes to other cryptos, that's where it gets a little tough because, you know, I don't know what else is exciting. You have Bitcoin, you have Ethereum, which Ethereum you have a lot of use cases for. And then I try to view the other crypto market outside of that. And I'm like, what is on the come up right now that's really exciting?
Honestly, the rest of it is just a huge, huge speculative bet.
Is like, that what it is? Okay.
As most crypto is anyway, but just beyond Bitcoin and Ethereum. And
yeah,
I really think you might as well go to the casino at that point and just learn how to play blackjack and start card counting. It's I mean, I'm not saying some of them are not going to be super successful, but... Yeah. I've just seen it throughout so many years of people being like, well, you just don't know what you're talking about. Or like, you don't know that you haven't done the research. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it doesn't matter what you think you know as far as the technology, the community, whatever it is. It just doesn't matter.
Mm.
Like, it's not, I mean, it matters.
Yeah.
But it's just, that's not what propels it to the, like, a relevant, you know, asset class or an asset. Yeah. It doesn't, like, Dogecoin is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
Like, could anyone have compared it to the thousands of cryptos that are out there, compare the technology and been like, no, Dogecoin is really the best one. It's not, right?
Yeah.
But the community is so strong, it just became a meme.
Yep.
And then Elon started to support it. So, I mean, could anyone have predicted that based on the fundamental metrics or something like that? No, it's impossible.
And
so,
update on Doge, where's that at? I think it's like 12 cents, 13 cents. And for reference, where was it at peak?
72 70 something.
Yeah, it was like 76. Dogecoin millionaire's portfolio, I believe, is close to 400, 450 or something.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot. Yeah. And he, what was it at? So at peak, he was what? Three mil? Wow.
3 million. I remember seeing it as 2.8 and being like, you could just swipe up right now. Like, literally just swipe up and you have $2.5 million in your account right now.
Yeah.
It's yours.
Wow.
And all you got to do is just. Boop.
It's so
hard. Me wanted to just take his phone. I would never do that. Just like, let me see it.
Oh, just
and
kidding.
Be like, yep, it's all sold.
Yeah, man, it's really tempting. Man. But from his perspective, because he's never been in crypto and he's never had that much money.
Yeah,
I don't think it makes sense to somebody who hasn't had that much money how much it's actually worth, how quickly you can lose it, and how this like. This feeling of FOMO of like, oh, it's going to keep going higher.
Yeah.
It's just at the peak. When you're seeing 3 mil, you're like, oh, this is going to keep going. Yeah. I'm going to be a decamillionaire
soon. I worry that he has the same expectation that it's following the trend of Bitcoin. And if he just waits long enough, it's going to go to a dollar. And maybe it will, but I don't. You just never know. No. To me, that's the same sort of mistake on that.
Yeah. And it's funny because we all have to make those mistakes and then look back and be like, now I know.
I don't think we all have to make a $3 million mistake like that. I mean, that's a very unique mistake.
Our own unique mistakes.
Imagine everyone has to make a $3 million mistake. Their portfolio is up $3 million and they just have to learn a lesson.
So I will say for me, I learned it with $100,000, which I think it was in 2017, 2016, which to me at that time, that was so much money.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing my portfolio skyrocket, which was when Bitcoin split off into Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, mm-hmm. and I just saw it skyrocket to like $111,000. Wow. And I was like, oh, this is going to keep going. This is it.
Late 2017.
And these narratives of like this mass global adoption, you just start to believe in it so much because it's like a self-reinforcing theory that you just hold on to everything and you forget that this, you know, it's a...
We're going to go way left here, okay, now. But this is interesting because I was thinking you were talking about 2016, 2017 you. And I don't even know how many people know this story that are probably watching this. You were somehow part of Now You See Me movie, right? Yes. Which is a super famous movie that, you know, I'm sure a ton of people have seen. Can you divulge any information about, like, you know, what you might have been paid or weren't paid, or like if you were well paid, where your role in that was?
That's a good question.
I don't even think a lot of people know that you were involved in that in any manner.
Yeah. So in 2014, I consulted on a movie called Now You See Me 2. That was the sequel.
So you consulted technically. Yes. That was your role.
Yeah, okay. I was a consultant for that. And originally I got involved in that project because the first movie, the executive producer for that movie, Bobby Cohen, mm-hmm. his son was a huge fan of magic and he would watch our magic videos. And the executive producer called us up and I flew to...
How'd
they get my number? Yeah. It was the company that I used to work for. It was a magic company. It was a very small kind of startup company. And they called us over and they're like, hey, let's get Andre to fly to New Orleans. And there's going to be a press junket with all the actors. He could go in there posing as an interviewer, which, by the way, for an actor, a press junket is like the worst part of their job because they just sit there for like 8 hours a day and having these people come in and ask them the same questions over and over. Like if you look at the actors, they're just so over it. They're grumpy. Anyway, so I came in there pretending I was another interviewer and had a deck of cards on me. I was like, oh, can I show you something? And they're like, sure. Yeah, please. Like, let me not be the monkey for once. So I showed them some card tricks and they're like, oh my God, because I do some card stuff and I'm okay. I'm all right. And so I showed them some stuff and they were like, dude, this is awesome. So anyway, they remembered us. And then for the second movie, the sequel, they called us back. And that's when I flew to London and stayed there for 2 months and I got to train the cast. Spent like 10 to 12 hours a day with the whole cast, just teaching them magic. It was super cool. But I was working for that company.
Okay.
And so I was an employee technically. So I got paid nothing extra for doing that. Yeah.
Whoa.
I'll share with you this. My salary at that time was $50,000 a year.
Wow. So a little under $1,000 a week.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
So that was for that movie, which it was the most probably exciting and coolest experience of my life.
Yeah.
It was also extremely like work intensive because it was 10 to 12 hour days for 2 months.
Two months you dedicated to that?
Yes.
Wow.
It was so cool.
Like, I figured it might have been like 2 days.
No, 100%. Like, I would do it again.
You can't learn that. Yeah.
No, whoa. Yeah. So that scene in the white lab where they're throwing the card. Mm-hmm. So I actually own that card. Like I have the hero card in the movie, that digital computer chip.
Yeah.
And that scene took, I believe, how long did it take? I think I want to say like 11 or 10 days to film that scene. They built this giant computer moving machine lab for hundreds of thousands of dollars that they had up for like 10 days. And then they completely just get rid of it and dismantle it.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So why is a scene like that take so long? You'd think it'd be like a day, maybe even something complicated. The way it looked in the movie is it was just recorded all at one time.
No, yeah. Here's the interesting part. So you may not have known this, but if you see two actors in the same shot, right? Mm-hmm. One where you see the back of the head and one you see where the front, right?
Yeah.
The person who's standing behind, like whose face you can't see, that is not that actor. That is a stand-in, somebody who kind of looks like them. Yeah. Every single scene that you'll ever see an actor with talking with someone else, like like either dialogue or something else, they only use one actor at a time. And every single scene, like every time the camera cuts to like a new scene, just imagine somebody just says, all right, cut. And then there's a 10 to 15 minute break where they have to reset the lights, the cameras, they have to move everything. And then 20 to 30 minutes later, they get the actors from their trailers to come back to the set. And then they shoot the next scene. And every single cut takes that.
Okay. And so was like, how involved were you in more than just that scene? You know, like how many scenes were you really part of? Cause I'm trying to figure out how big of a part of that movie you might've been.
The whole movie.
Really?
The whole movie. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's insane. And to think like, you know, obviously it's such a cool experience, but to think you didn't financially benefit.
Yeah.
almost at all.
No, but I got to see a lot of things. Yeah, it was probably one of the coolest experiences. But there was one bet where the director, John Chu, he had a kind of a bet with the actors where Woody Harrelson and Dave Franco, they were throwing cards between each other.
Okay.
And they got so good. Like they would stand opposite of each other, like 20 feet apart.
Yep.
And they would just take a single card and they would throw it back and forth to each other.
Wow.
Or rather not back and forth to each other, but Woody would throw to Dave and Dave would just catch it. How many can he catch in a row, right? Like 10, you know, consistently. And they just basically scammed the director because they were like, hey, if we could do 10, like you owe us 100. And he's like, all right, let's do it. And so they would pretend to like suck.
Yeah.
They would just do incredible. Oh, wow. And like, all right, let's double or nothing. It was such a cool experience. I have so many like fun stories from that.
Who is the coolest person in your opinion?
Everybody was so really cool. The chemistry on set was so cool. It was amazing.
Yeah, because I mean, I think a lot of people would think, oh, you know, actors and actresses, they got to be like, you know, super off.
I will say Morgan Freeman, just like before the movie starts shooting, they have a table read, right? Where they go through and they just read the whole movie through the script. And guys like Morgan Freeman, who have been in the industry for so long, they don't need to show up to those. They're just,
they
have their own thing.
Yeah,
they've been doing it for so long. It's just like they play by different rules.
Who are you nervous to meet, if anybody?
Daniel Radcliffe.
Okay.
Yeah, because he's like Harry Potter, right? I was such a huge fan of his, and I still am.
Wow.
And I told him that like right before we started working. I was like, dude, I'm such a huge fan of yours. He's like, oh, don't even worry about it, dude. I get it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. No, that's a cool experience, but yeah, it's nuts.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Now, in the magic industry, like who's really making bank? Like David Blaine, is he making like 20 million a year?
Oh, you'd be surprised. So it's so interesting. When you're a magician, the career, the perspective that people have of you is like, do you have your own show here in Vegas? You're like, no. They're like, oh, so you're broke. Like,
yeah.
That's so the people's perception.
It's either
you're David Copperfield or you're like just a
guy in Las Vegas.
Wow. With a deck of cards, yeah. But what people don't know is that there's like 3 to 4 different layers of working magicians that actually make really good money.
Okay.
Like I would say the corporate level magician, they make anywhere between $100,000 to $300,000 a year easily.
Because what's a corporate level magician?
Corporate level magicians are people that go to say casinos or businesses and they'll perform for employee events like award ceremonies or they'll just travel around the world or even in the U.S., like they'll just perform for, let's say, Coca-Cola or Microsoft.
Ooh.
They'll be keynote speakers for new products, whatever it is.
Okay.
And they get paid insane amounts of money. Like some of my friends get paid $30,000 to $50,000 per gig.
Oh, it's and so you still keep up with the magic industry?
Yes, loosely, but
It's
incredible how much money you can make. Like before I started my YouTube channel, the only thing I was subsisting on, because like I wasn't making any money, because I turned everything down. Wow. I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to focus on YouTube.
Yeah.
Because that was the only way that I could do it.
Yeah.
I was like, I need to be starving literally to like just do it, right? Mm. So the only income that I had at the time was to perform for corporate. So for the casinos, I would go to the Wynn for their employee events.
Wow.
They would pay me $2,500 to show up and just perform magic walking around
and that's
for
insane.
An hour. For an hour.
Wow. Yeah.
$2,500 Yeah.
Yeah. That's
how often
insane.
Would that happen though?
I mean, for people that are actually like working and they work on relationships, which I'm the worst at, I don't network very well.
Yeah.
They get those, you know, 5-6 times a month.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's just one of those, right? They'll get different ones, but yeah. So there's a level beneath the whole David Copperfield stage persona that is people can make. I know magicians that make over $1 million a year.
Wow!
Being keynote speakers for like Wall Street in New York, like it's crazy.
Who's technically the hottest magician right now?
You wouldn't know who they are if I mentioned their name.
Oh, okay. Let's see.
No,
try us.
No, trust me. You wouldn't know.
Okay.
But please mention somebody.
So what makes them so hot?
Everyone's going to be curious. Yeah. The audience, like, you're not going to know them.
Well, I'll say two. Justin Willman and Dave Williamson.
Okay. Are they kind of more on the underground? Because
they're not underground. Actually, Justin Willman has a show on Netflix. He's got his own special.
Okay.
Magic for Humans, I believe.
Ooh.
And David Williamson is an older magician, but he's like... Like if Jim Carrey could be a magician, that's him.
Oh wow!
Like he's so good. Like the best magicians, you can take away their deck of cards and they'll entertain you for hours and still be funny. And like that's really the best people.
Yeah. And in terms of on the strip, what is it? About five people have big shows on the strip, would you say, or is it like three people have big shows? I see the guy. What is it, Shin Lim?
Shin Lim.
Yeah. That's a billboard I see all the time.
Yeah, I see his. Face
yeah.
everywhere.
That's a good friend of mine. Yeah. I've known him before he blew up, like before America's Got Talent.
Oh, yeah. So that's how he got big.
Yeah. America's Got Talent.
I see.
Yeah.
And then his show, where is that at? Treasure Island? MGM?
No, Mirage.
Mirage. Okay. Yeah.
No, he's incredibly talented.
Is he the biggest on the strip right now or?
Biggest? I don't know. What do you define as biggest?
Well, like crowd size, maybe.
He does not have the biggest theater. No, okay. I don't believe so.
Is that his fault or is it just kind of like the position he's put in?
No, it's interesting. The AGT contract is terrifying because it's like we own you throughout the universe in perpetuity. That's one of the lines that's in the contract for AGT.
Wow.
We like throughout the universe in perpetuity is literally a line in the contract.
Wow.
So like they own your material, your like because technically if you win AGT and you become famous, they created that product.
Yeah.
You are that brand they created. And so they own usually like at least 50% of everything you do forever.
No. Yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Alex, what a scam.
It's not.
Wow. Like
that. Yeah. And that $1 million bonus prize that is promised to the winner can be paid out in any choosing for. So you can either be paid out, I believe, immediately, like $600,000, or take the $1 million over a longer period of time.
Because but that longer, it's probably an annuity.
Yeah, but that longer period of time is completely discretionary to AGT. So they could pay you $1 a year for 30 years and then pay you the other $990,000 whenever. It's very different. Yeah. Show business
is different. What's their viewership? Like how many people would see something on an average night?
For AGT?
Yeah.
Oh, I have no idea.
It's got to be millions.
But imagine it's like 10 to 20 million going into this thing. We're going to show you to 10 million people. Yeah. And if anything happens, I bet that's a catalyst for a lot of people that they never would have gotten otherwise. So sometimes it's better to get half of something than, nothing.
Yeah.
Anything.
For sure. 100%. But Shin Lim's manager is actually his mom, and she is incredible. Like she negotiated the best deal for him. Yeah.
Wow.
So he has to give half of his income.
I can't say what his contract is, but it is unlike any other contract I've ever seen before. Impressive. Like it's the best.
I wonder if you could almost threaten and just say, hey, well, I'm not going to work. Or, you know,
like, all right, we'll find all these other people that are also talented.
And that's the thing, too. Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, how those Vegas shows work. Because, you know, for instance, like Adele was going to have a show for a while. And then I think it was at Caesars.
Yep.
And then from my understanding, what happened is Caesars wasn't doing it up to her level, which I imagine, you know, this is Adele, like one of the biggest musicians of the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years. And, you know, here we are in this situation where she ended up pulling the show and not doing it.
Well, here's an interesting perspective. So Chris Angel, when he got the Cirque du Soleil deal here in town with Luxor. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah, I definitely heard of him. Okay. Yeah, he was huge probably around, what was that, 2010-ish?
2000s,
Early 2000s.
Early
2000s,
okay. Something like that, And Mind Freak, right? The special, if you guys remember?
I watched a show. Was it VH1 or MTV?
Yes, one of those. And so give you a perspective. He signed a 10-year deal with Luxor, or with Cirque du Soleil, my bad, for 10 years for $100 million, right? Which is it's nutty. It's insane. Yeah. But Katy Perry, who showed up to Resort World recently, okay. right? She's doing a residency here for 2 months.
Okay.
You know what World Resorts paid her for that 2 month contract?
Shoot, I don't know. How many shows was she doing first off?
Gosh, I don't know her schedule. Like 5 to 7, I'm guessing, a week?
Okay. 5 to 7 a week, it's probably $500,000 per show. So $3.5 million a week.
I was gonna say, yeah, I was gonna say 500 on the low 12. End, but I was thinking probably about $1 million
My guess,
an episode.
$25 million in 2 months.
No, it's closer to $160 million.
No. Yeah. Oh, you know what? You gotta think how many people go to the casino and gamble and lose money. Mm-hmm. That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible. Oh my gosh.
In 2 months.
Wow.
What took Chris Angel 10 years to not even come close to that.
Yep.
Oh
just
my
to
gosh.
Give you a perspective. So it's interesting to me because the truth is Katy Perry's not going to make that much money in 2 months. Like, it's impossible. Even though I will say Corey and I went to go see her show. Amazing. So cool.
Oh yeah, I love Katy Perry.
I paid $50 for 2 drinks.
Yeah, it's like
two
the club.
Drinks.
You ever
dude.
Went to Omni? Oh my gosh, it's like $50 for 1 drink. I've never dude. Went, but I just know people that have gone.
It's insane, right? Yeah. I mean, still, that's not going to make them their money back, but just goes to show you that I feel like, especially foreign money, like all that's the Asian market for World Resorts. Yeah. Maybe it's like a loss leader. It's like, hey, we don't care, just to get people through the door to get them to play and spend money, like. It's worth the brand awareness.
Wow.
It's insane, yeah.
And then I bet it's pretty big to get other acts afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you're going to follow up Katy Perry.
Exactly.
I don't know. That sort of prestige is going to carry
it
on for a little bit.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, a big musician will make like $2 million to $3 million a concert, like when they're on tour. Like, if you're huge, like massive, like 2 to 3. Like, Katy Perry could probably make like 2 to 3, per concert she does, assuming it was in either massive arenas or stadiums, because a lot of the biggest artists do stadiums now. So,
can you imagine doing one show and being like, all right, cool, I made a mil. All right,
yeah,
a couple mil.
That's
insane.
It's like, my gosh, and then it's so hard to do anything else. Think about Floyd Mayweather. Make $100 million plus in a night. In a night.
Well, that's because he didn't pay Logan.
He gets to
keep the whole thing.
Dude, Logan, I think, made like 40 or 50 mil off.
Well, someday if he gets paid.
I thought, I heard
Wait,
it was
he
like
never
20.
Got paid? You're not kidding.
I heard Logan was about 20. And I forget who, like, I don't know if
it
was
40.
Now, Floyd's getting 100. I mean, it would make sense that Floyd gets to keep like 80%.
Yeah.
Logan's 20.
It's so fascinating to me because I feel like, regardless of what you think of, Logan Paul and his brother, I feel like their presence really made boxing relevant again.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it was irrelevant. I'm just saying that, between him and Mayweather, it just made me want to, I've never seen boxing in my life.
Yeah.
And I flew to Miami to watch that fight. I was in the second row.
Yeah.
Like, that was so cool to see. I've never seen a professional fight before.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know if it's a professional fight, but
I remember
exhibition.
I had an argument with a friend who we always argue about everything, but I was telling him, this is in probably about 2017. And I said, there's this Logan Paul, Jake Paul kid. And I was like, you wait, they're going to be two of the biggest celebrities in the world. Like, they're going to be like, maybe like under like a Kardashian, level, but they're going to be massive. And obviously they just became so big, man, like way bigger than their YouTube channels or anything like that. It's incredible. They just kept taking. So there's one of my favorite videos on YouTube. I'll have to show, it's such a random video. It's a video of this guy got in Floyd Mayweather's car after Floyd Mayweather fought Canelo in like 2014. Mm-hmm. And they're just driving. And he drives to McDonald's. This is right after he made, I don't know, $50 million or whatever in that fight. And he's just talking and they're just listening to music and whatnot. And then they go to McDonald's, which is in Southern Highlands. And he's waiting at the gas pumps. And it's just Floyd Mayweather, none of his bodyguards, and this guy filming him. And he's waiting there and he's like, can't go anywhere because there's some people spotted him or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then he goes up and he's like, yeah, let me get 4 sausage egg McMuffins, but with no sausage. And it's just so funny that he's like, he just made $50 million. And here he is at like 3 a.m. going to McDonald's and ordering sausage egg McMuffins with no bodyguards or anything.
Yeah, but the McDonald's is good at 3 a.m. though.
Yeah, it is.
You tell me another meal at 3 a.m. that's better than
that. It's
delicious. Yeah.
You know what's interesting? All the influencers that I've met, that even people like Logan Paul, who sometimes may not have a good rep, but meeting them in person and getting to know them, it's such a completely different vibe from who they are versus who they are online or perceived to be, because everything they do, like, they are genius marketers, and everything they do is completely intentional and thought through, and it is not like this like the media makes it seem like, oh, it's just like this dumb kid.
Yeah.
Like, no, these are some of the smartest people you'll ever meet.
The fact that they're being talked about means they're doing something right.
Exactly. Yeah.
I know. Even with Mayweather's like bodyguards and whatnot, I'm pretty sure he just does that for like a kind of positioning.
Yeah.
For instance, I saw him one time at Caesar's Palace at Forum Shops. I would have never had any clue Floyd Mayweather's right there, but I saw all these massive bodyguards that are like taller than me, but like, dude, like 300 pounds. And I'm like, what the heck's going on? Like, these guys are massive. And then all of a sudden I see little Floyd there. He's like, you know,
like my height.
He's like 140 pounds or whatever he was, or, you know, and he's like in the mix. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And then there's like this group of girls behind him. And I'm like, oh gosh. But I would have had no clue that was Floyd Mayweather to walk by me if it wasn't for all those big bodyguards. But
yeah.
Yeah.
He was on his way to McDonald's.
No, his Cheesecake Factory. Oh, he went to the Cheesecake Factory.
Dude, the watch collection he has is nuts. Yeah. Mayweather. Speaking of watches, Graham, you bought, can we say, did you, what kind of watch you bought? This was a while ago, but I don't know if you've ever announced it.
I did. After Hours channel, the Patek Philippe.
Can I?
5196P.
I'll ask after, but I actually want to see. I've never seen it.
Oh.
Yeah, I've worn it twice.
Oh,
yeah. How much the crazy thing, so I bought it for 33, and I always look.
33,000, by the way, not 3,300.
Yeah, 33,000. But I always keep track of the prices. Now they're selling about 39 to 41.
Wow.
Yeah, so that watch went up in value a decent, like, basically the S&P 500 year over year.
Yeah, so I want to get your guys' opinion for a watch that I've been looking at.
Okay.
What about the F. Pigeon Blue?
I don't know. I don't know much about that brand.
That's the one Kevin O'Leary talks about all the time.
Mm. All right. Yeah, I don't know. I'm horrible with watches.
Yeah, I don't know much about that, unfortunately, so I can comment on that.
But you have Rolexes. You have one
Rolex, yeah.
Which one do you have?
The Datejust Blue Dial.
Wow, okay. Yeah. How much? Oh, you got it for...
Yeah, that was a gift.
Wow.
That was a gift from Grant Navarre. So huge thank you to Grant.
Oh, Grant gave it to
you.
Yeah,
it was Grant Navarre who gave that to me when I hit 2 million subscribers as literally just like as a gift. He did some pretty big real estate deals. And some of that was like through the videos of learning real estate and whatnot, watching the channel. And so when he did these deals, he was like, I just want to celebrate 2 million subscribers. So he got me this watch and engraved on the back, it says 2 million subscribers.
Wow.
And even that watch has doubled in value. And
that's nuts.
And now he's a big Rolex guy. So he has quite a few Rolexes. He has good relationships with dealers and, you know, ADs, secondhand and everything. Yeah, exactly. But even that watch has doubled.
Wow.
And talking to him, because he's really educated about Rolex, he sold some of his watches and said that now he would have been better off just having held on to them longer because they're even more valuable. Like the Rolex Daytona right now was a watch that would MSRP about $12,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're $40,000.
But Grant, why don't you sell your Patek now that it's appreciated?
Every watch I get is in some way sentimental.
Okay.
So to me, it's just like, I don't know. Why sell it? What else am I going to do? Like, I like the watch. Watches, to me, are very similar to real estate, where I really want to buy them with the intention of keeping forever.
Sell your house, Andre.
But not the watch.
But not the watch. Not the $40,000 watch.
Gosh. Here's the thing. Because I bought the watch. Yeah. See, I bought the watch from Federico. It's Federico Talks Watches. And
it's a YouTuber.
Yeah.
His name is Federico. You got to put the roll on the R, baby.
But some of it is like, if I'm buying the watch, I'm not going to go and be that guy who resells it.
Right.
You know, obviously, if someone was like, here's $100,000, I'd call him and be like, hey, man,
yeah,
this cool. I would never want to ruin a relationship for selling a watch.
Right. So for normal people actually watching this, alternative assets are kind of an interesting asset class. Do you guys do anything? I know you do cars, you do watches. Mm-hmm. Jeremy, I know you bought the Pokemon box.
And I might buy more in the future.
Yeah. So I didn't know this. Well, I should have known. I forgot. But I walked into Jeremy's house, and at the top shelf, he has a base set booster box of Pokemon cards, which is one of the holy grails of Pokemon. I was like, wow, dude, you've got that. That's cool. So you do a little bit of a little something on the side with alternative assets.
Yeah, and I might buy more because they've gone down recently.
Do you have anything else?
No. I just have 4 silver play buttons, Graham Stephan. What you know about 4 silver play buttons?
I think I have 4 too.
Oh my gosh. You probably have 5. Dang it.
Graham Stephan, Graham Stephan Show, Iced Coffee Hour, Millennial Money.
Oh crap. And I think you got another channel you're probably forgetting about. No?
With the Graham Stephan After Hours. But that's 65,000 subscribers.
Okay, we're tied for now. Dang it. I got to start 4. A fifth channel.
I've only got 2. I'm way behind you guys.
Yeah, but you have gold.
I do have the gold. That's
true.
You have
gold. You're on your way to diamond, baby.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's just going to be a long grind. Huh.
Give me 10 years.
Hey, what happened to the finance space, guys? I'm depressed. I think I don't know what happened to us, man. The finance space, we lost some momentum. It's YouTube. I don't know what happened. Is it because people aren't making money? Like, I've just been looking at the finance space, and I just feel like we've got no momentum right now. I feel like I'm trying to find like exciting creators on the come up, and it's hard for me to say like, oh, that's the next Andre, or that's like the next Meet Kevin or me or you guys. And I'm just like, dang, man, it seems like we're just in a rut on YouTube. I don't know. Maybe I have a very negative perception of what's going on.
You have
right
a negative
now.
Perception okay. on it. Yeah. I just think other things are taking the forefront. I mean, obviously everything between
finance
Russia,
is cyclical
Ukraine
too.
Yeah. is taking a lot of it. I think some news topics are doing really well.
Okay.
In terms of like gas prices and stuff like that. But day to day, it's not that much different. And so having experienced 2020,
yeah.
which is like crazy stuff happening every day, like anomalies were happening on like a weekly basis that had to be talked about. Stimulus checks, like everyone was hanging on to the idea of $2,000 like a week or something like that.
Yeah.
2021 came around. There was a trail off from that, but then we had like some crazy crypto rides in the very beginning.
AMC,
stocks,
Dogecoin.
AMC, GameStop. Yep. Then stocks rallied and you have still a lot of people staying at home. So I think just that momentum really carried through for 2021. Now that the market's somewhat flat year over year, I think it's people are like, you know, I don't want to say bored with it, but like when you're in that middle phase, it's not that exciting.
That's true. Yeah, you're either not losing a bunch of money or necessarily making a bunch of money. And yeah, it's been a while since anybody's made any money from crypto.
True.
It's been a while since anybody made any money from stocks. And I mean, if you look at most of the retail stocks, right, the ones that, you know, retail bought, a lot of those are down, you know, between 50 and 90%.
We need a good YOLO story. So, like he YOLO'd, you know, his life savings into this stock.
I don't know. I remember telling Jeremy, I'm like, dude, we could enter a time where like for the next 5 years, it's going to be pretty up and down flat.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he saying, no. I wouldn't be surprised if 5 years from now, we've just gone up and down 20%. Up 20, down 20.
Yeah.
Up 20, down
20.
My point was, you know, first off, probably unlikely, but my other point is, if you have that sort of scenario, there will be a lot of stocks that still outperform and do amazing during that time period.
Right.
If you're in the right sort of companies, you don't need necessarily stock market to go up.
It's
every
like finding
year.
A needle in a haystack, though, at that point.
I wouldn't call it that. I would call it, you know, I'd call it more difficult, certainly. Yeah. I mean, if the whole market goes up 20% a year, your life just got a lot easier as a stock picker.
It's like finding a penny in a football field.
Yeah.
More doable.
That.
Yeah, more doable.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, goodness. Well, I don't know. We'll see. But what I do know is, you know, obviously over time, everything's incentivized to go up.
Some of the top private equity people are saying that in the next, until like 2035, I saw a study that will stay probably under 5% until 2035.
5% what? Interest rates?
No.
Or what?
ROI.
Your ROI, yeah.
Oh, okay.
For the stock market.
But they've been saying that for a while.
They have.
So I've looked back. I love doing one of my favorite things is you go on Google and then you sort by time and you could look up almost anything you want to, like recession, and then look that up 2004 to 2006. You could see all the articles posted back then. And I've done that for the lost decade.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since the 2001.com bubble, if you go back, Google 2002, lost decade, you'll see it like, oh, this is going to be the lost decade. This every year they say the lost decade.
Right, that's true.
So it's interesting how everyone calls it every year.
But this time it's different.
This time is different.
It's true though. As far as if you pay attention to interest rates, and we talked about this lots of times before.
But the same was said in 2018 when interest rates were going up, and they said this is the lost decade. 2019.
No. I'm talking about when rates were zero. That like we are at now. Well, now I guess now we're coming up. But I'm just saying, when rates are zero, that's when people like Warren Buffett come out and say, hey, just the next decade, expect there to be not much of a performance in the stock market because we can't stimulate it with rates, guys. We're already at zero.
Yeah, until the rates go back down.
You have to be really pessimistic, I feel, to think, you know, the stock market won't do well over a five-year span, in my opinion. Well, like, really pessimistic.
Do you think the stock market, or like, what do you think would happen if tomorrow Jerome Powell was like, hey, you know what, I'm increasing rates to 5% now.
Yeah, that would hurt.
What do you think would happen?
Yeah. I think mark it down 10% that day. It would be vicious. Yeah. It would be what they call it, the limits would be hit, you know, and they'd be like, oh, we'll close the market for the next 30
circuits
minutes.
Circuits breakers.
Yeah. Oh, we flipped another one, closing it down. But yeah, that would be vicious.
Make
but,
for a good video, though.
Yeah, that, views that day. If we want to get the momentum back going in the finance community, just have the market go down 10% a day. Oh man,
I'm saying, do you think the economy could support that kind of move without going into a recession?
Boy, that's such a deep subject.
But the thing is, it's the sentiment.
Yeah,
and it's like that's what it really it's demoralizing for a lot of people. Oh no, now a savings account is paying 6% interest.
Yeah,
the economy could go down. I better save the money instead.
Yeah,
better not invest. That's probably the bigger risk.
Yeah, the long term, the only thing I ever worry about is people not having kids. I worry about that.
That's the Elon Musk worry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I will say the one advantage we have in the United States of America is people always want to come to the United States of America to live. Right. It was interesting. I was looking up where most people are moving from to Arizona, and I think it was like the fifth one. Obviously, California was number one. The fifth one was Asia, which just blew my mind, because you would think it'd be some other state, right? And it's like Asia in general, like to Arizona. That's interesting. But that's the one thing I will say is good, is there's this massive, you know, 8 billion population or whatever, and we can always just keep having folks move to the United States. But I do worry about if people decide they're not going to have kids, or they're only going to have one kid or something like that. That's just, at the end of the day, you run the numbers, there's less people to buy iPhones. Yeah. It's less people to buy.
So you want people to have kids so your stocks do better, Jeremy.
Yes, 100%. And so the economy's strong. Yeah. Because, I mean, imagine you're in a scenario where, let's just say no one had any kid. Oh, that'd be unrealistic, because then society would end, right? Yeah. The world would end. But if everybody decided not to have kids, the economy shrinks. That's just the way it's going to work. Mm. And you look at one of the reasons Japan had, a horrible market for, probably a decade, 2 decades or whatever. And that's a time period people like to look back at. One of the big reasons was, look at their population. Look at their population and look at their stock market.
Right. If anything, I feel like the time period that we're living through right now with the Ukraine and Russia war, it just makes me realize how lucky we all are to be living in a country that we can actually put our money somewhere for it to grow.
Yeah.
So I feel like if you're living in Ukraine right now, like that's the least of your worries. You just want to make sure you survive. But even if that was not a worry, I just feel like we're so fortunate being a world reserve currency where, countries all around the world need and want our dollars. So we're like, when we print money, that excess money is absorbed by other countries' needs to trade and buy oil and commodities. And that's why when we inflate our supply, our asset prices go up. Mm-hmm. Because it's absorbed by those assets, right? That excess money is like the assets are like a sponge that absorb this excess money. Mm. Whereas in other countries, that's not the case.
Yeah.
And I imagine people that are young people, especially like living right now in Ukraine, like how much their lives have just changed in the last like few weeks.
Yeah.
Like not just financially, but like otherwise.
Oh,
so,
yeah, horrible.
I don't know. When you think about like being lucky and just being appreciative of where we're at, I think it's so cool.
It's 100%. And I think that's just another reason why I think a lot of people from around the world like to move here over time.
Yeah.
You know, because they just look at it and they're like, oh, shoot, you know.
Yeah.
They got the big sticks over there.
Yeah. So,
and that's the only thing that really gives, there's two things that really give the United States a lot of power. One is the dollar.
Yep.
And two is we got the biggest sticks, and that's always a good thing to have. So, and as much as I hate all the military spending, we spend so much on military. And if you look at the budgets, and you know, it's a debate I have with people all the time, and it's like, oh my gosh, do we really need to spend this much on military? Like seriously?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day,
that's why you enjoy the life that you do.
Exactly. And that's the toughest part of that. It's like, it's annoying, but it's like, I wish we didn't have to be like that.
Right.
I wish we didn't need
all
this stuff.
Don't worry, we soon won't have to.
Oh,
no, I'm just kidding. I don't know how soon, but to Ray Dalio's point, it's so fascinating that what makes a country so successful that eventually leads it to come to the top is literally baked into the ingredients for its failure. because the stronger the currency and the country is, the less competitive it becomes. Because if your labor and the people you work for, the people that are in your country, they want to be paid a lot of money. Like people in the US make a lot of money relative to other countries.
Yep.
The stuff we produce, the labor we have here is extremely expensive, which makes us less competitive.
We've got it. Yeah. The main thing for me that really, if you want confidence in the United States outside of the dollar and outside of our big sticks, let's call it that, is innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
if
true.
You really think about like, who are the most game-changing companies in the world?
Right.
Not in the United States, in the world. NVIDIA, AMD, Tesla,
Apple,
Netflix, Apple, Facebook, Google.
Yeah.
These, you know, Microsoft, these companies run the world.
True.
And so for that reason, we're always in a... Now, if we ever stop producing those sorts of companies, then I'm scared.
Right.
Then I'm really scared. But as long as we produce those, because those are the companies that end up making, you know, 50,000 jobs, 100,000 jobs, 200,000 jobs, and helping out the stock market in a massive way because their profitability.
The problem though is manufacturing, because other companies could take this glass and then just find a way to do it better for cheaper.
Well, see, that's where innovation comes.
Right.
You have to keep it coming out with stuff that no one's done or no one's thinking of. The glass is like, you know, everybody can do that.
Providing that framework allows other areas to basically catch up faster.
Yeah.
So I think the catch up will be a lot quicker.
Yeah,
it's the blueprint's already there. It's like, here's how to build it.
One of the other biggest, you know, advantages we have is our VC system, because a lot of these companies aren't profitable. You know, most of the biggest tech companies that have been built, whether you're talking about Uber and Lyft or whether you're talking about Facebook's or whatever, they lost money for a long time. They didn't flip to profitability for 5-10 years. So because we got that VC system in place where we can pump tens of millions, hundreds of millions, or even billions of dollars in the private markets into these companies that are money losers that end up becoming the Goliath companies, that's a huge advantage, because most countries, they don't have that.
Right.
They don't have that. It's almost like an unfair advantage. We have a lot of unfair advantages. And that's why I think if you're ever pessimistic about the United States of America, the stock market, the real estate market, when you just start really running through this and you really start viewing it through the whole system, you realize how many sick competitive advantages we have.
No, yeah, that's true.
You know, the dollar in the military is just the start.
Right.
And then you start going layer by layer beneath and you realize, oh my gosh, we're really like playing our own little game here.
This is true. It'll definitely take some time. I thought what Jerome Powell said was really interesting. He said you could have more than one world reserve currency. We have never existed in a time where that's been the case.
Yeah.
But I could see that being the case.
Do want to mention this, that a new study just found that millennials think more about watering their plants and what they're about to eat for dinner than they do about their personal finances.
Whoa.
That's crazy.
Which is bullish for the chef. TTCF to the moon,
what
baby.
Thinking about dinner.
Yes. BYND.
Oh, and then by the way, 50% of millennials had no idea how much is in their bank account, and they trust auto pay to make sure their bills get taken care of.
I'm in that second group of auto pay, but not the first one.
They have no clue how much is in their account.
Oh, I fit that category.
You don't know?
You ever do that with doctors, though? Like, you're like, I don't want to know what's wrong with me. I just don't want to know. I don't want to go to the doctor.
Not to look at it.
Better not to look at it.
Better not to know.
Usually, I'm down to my last couple hundred thousand. I'm always like, I'm so broke.
The thing you said,
I'm so broke.
Your last $1 million in cash.
It's so depressing.
Through the roof.
I don't even want to look at it. I'm like, why did I spend all this money on stocks?
Welcome to Millennial Money, the most relatable podcast you'll ever watch.
Well, you know what? All right. Well, I'm going to go buy a Tesla. Gas prices are too high.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah,
gas prices too high?
Yeah.
Pro tip, go buy a Tesla.
Yeah, they're actually not that expensive. They're like 80, 90 grand.
All right.
I'm kidding.
Give us an outro, Graham.
Thank you guys so much for watching. Let us know what you think of this format down below in the comments section. If you guys enjoy it, let us know if you guys
And if you don't enjoy it, just keep it to yourself. That'd be cool, too. Ooh.
No. How about this? Offer if there's something you would want to see that we're not offering you, just let us know. Constructive criticism, I think, goes a long way. How about that?
Sure. Don't read the comments.
I'm all for
Graham and I will
criticism.
Read the comments.
I'll read
all
them.
Right.
I'll read them. Anyway, thank you so much. Also, big thank you to FTX. Again, their link is down below in the description. Andre is going to bury his head in the sand. And we'll
pretend
see you next
like
week.
Nothing's wrong. I don't want to check my bank account.
All right. Bye.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Save a little more this month. Chime checking accounts have features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe and no monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply.